Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts, typically with a focus on Kenpo. I am Reggie, and today we have Mr. Paul Britton on, a wonderful wonderful guest. We're going to get into his story and his journey in Kenpo and in the martial arts, and just kind of whatever other items that we happen to get onto, we'll talk about those as well. So I usually start things off with just kind of giving a brief history of my background, but I'm not going to get into that too much because I'm sure you all have heard me many, many times. So basically just say that I currently train in five different martial arts at this point. Kenpo, Capoeira, Hapkido, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai. I've done some boxing, so I stay pretty busy. And with this show, I get to talk to wonderful people. So we'll see what we get into as we go along. But going to turn things over to my guest today, and yeah, we're going to get into where did Kenpo find you? Where did it all start? Where was that spark that started your martial arts journey?
Well, the spark that started it was not Kenpo. Back several years, back to the wonderful 70s. Before we say that, I was born March 11th, 1962. So I've reached the wonderful age of 63 years old and still going strong. Back at that point, I was living in San Bernardino, California. And at that time, I had never heard Kenpo. Of course, even though Los Angeles was prevalent, lies. The only thing I heard of at that point was Taekwondo, Shotokan, Ishinryu. And everywhere you looked, there was a Taekwondo studio. So at that point, what do? If you're interested in martial arts, you go to the first school that you find. Now, what caught my attention was a friend of mine who told me about, and no disrespect in this statement, a guy named Bruce Lee. And at that time, there was a movie called The Game of Death, which I forgot how many times I saw it. And I was captivated by every single thing he did. The first nunchuck scene all the way through his fights. And that was wonderful. Along with that, it was Chuck Norris, Bill Wallace, you know, all the greats. And I did that for the longest time. But there's a book called The Kenpo Continuum Part 2, which is done by Amy Long, in which I had the pleasure of being involved in that project as far as my story and era. But, you know, being in the art of Taekwondo, it was great. And I thought that was the world. That was it. But what really triggered it for me is in the book, I explained that without getting too personal in it, my mom and dad separated when I was five. So it was a constant of moving around with different sisters and their husbands to get a great role model, so to speak. Well, I went to Oregon, where my mother sent me there, and I was on the patio, and I was practicing a Taekwondo form. My brother-in-law looked out, and he looked at me and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing a Taekwondo form." And he said, "Well, if you're doing it wrong, or you're just not good at it." There was nothing wrong with the form. It's just that he was right. I wasn't good at it. We went inside the kitchen, and he opened up the phone book. He said, "Let's see what we can do with this." I thought, "Oh, great. Where are you going to send me?" So he opened up the yellow pages and saw an ad called Ed Park Kenpo Karate on West 11th Street. And, of course, if you've never heard of it, the first thing you say is, "What the heck is Kenpo?" Never heard of it. It's, you know, different. Well, when we went down to the studio, I met Mark Parker, no relation to Ed Parker. While in there, I also met Daniel Waltha, who was later, I guess, a student of Larry Tatum's. And I got a private lesson with a guy named Alex Ferrari. At that time, he was a purple belt. And that was my wake-up call. Taekwondo was great. I can't deny it. But Alex Ferrari showed me some of the self-defense techniques. And afterwards, we had a small sparring session. He basically wiped the floor with me. And it was not an embarrassing moment. It was just simply a wake-up call. I thought, this is real. This is fantastic. That's what started the remainder of my lifelong journey in Kenpo. At that time, I still had no idea who Ed Parker was, no idea who Master Tan was or anybody else. All I knew is that what I was learning in that school was wonderful. Now, didn't stay there that long. Because of situations in life, I moved around quite a bit. But I'm going to jump ahead several years to the 90s. When I got to Louisiana, I had several years, I owned about 5 martial arts schools, within maybe 10 or 20 miles of each other. But the real beginning of it was when I met Chuck Sullivan and Vic LaRue, both present grandmasters. And the reason why I found them is because I went to one of the local grocery stores and picked up a Black Belt magazine, and I saw an ad for the Karate Connection. And I thought, okay, I said, lean and mean Kenpo. So what I did is I had a student at the time who was the former mayor of the city. And I was also working for the police department there. And the next thing you know, we agreed to go and contact them, get their videos, and get out for there to do a seminar for us. That turned into a yearly 11-year training deal, which was wonderful. Now, my years before that, with all the different people I associated with as far as instructors, the biggest issue that I ran into was instructors telling me, just do the technique, you figure it out, okay? If you teach me something and you tell me I'll figure it out, how it works, that's not the answer that I'm looking for. I want instructors who were knowledgeable enough to tell me how to do it, why it works. Don't just tell me to figure it out. That's not what I needed. When that came out, one of the greatest gifts that Grandmaster Sullivan gave was the explanation of the basics. The original Parker system, and I still got the original charts, had so many basics to them, so many different listings, that it was almost like as big as the art itself. Grandmaster Sullivan cut those basics down to the point to where it was like magic. And I joined the Karate Connection, stayed with them for several years. And while I was with them, I went from my 4th degree to 8th degree. And after that, I broke off to do some other things. But the gift that those two grandmasters gave cannot be replaced. It's priceless. And Grandmaster Sullivan is still going strong today, even in his 90s. And that's something you don't see every day. Because what's happening is the first generations, it's that we're losing them. And thing I wanted to read on Facebook was the passing of Huck Planus. But even though I was with the Karate Connection, my question here, I still had a love for the original Parker system. But the issue I found, and the biggest thing people would tell me is, the system is so large, so big, that nobody can see the light at the end of the tunnel. So what I did is I sat down and I set out to put together, not recreate the Parker system, that didn't need to be done, but to set out to put together a system that you could actually see the light at the end. You could see it was reachable.
Okay, I think we're back on track there. So just for the listeners, had a little technical difficulties, but we're back on track here. So in case you didn't realize from my seamless editing skills, we had a little bump there, but we're back on track here. So we may kind of backtrack a little bit here, but we'll get all the story together. So out of the things that you were mentioning there, wanted to cover go back and cover a few things. First thing being, so what was the thing that got you interested in the martial arts? So you mentioned that you originally found the Taekwondo system, and like what was the driving factor that got you interested in the arts in the first place?
Well, the first part of it started when I was living in San Bernardino, California. And the first thing that got me interested in martial arts, of course, was watching a Bruce Lee movie called Game of Death, along with watching the Chuck Norris movies. And around that time frame, the only thing that was really around that I knew of was Taekwondo, Shotokan, or Isshin-Ryu. And the predominant style around there were schools of Taekwondo. And I did that until I went to Oregon. And then, of course, Oregon is where the world of Kenpo opened up for me.
Gotcha. Now, was I mean we all know and love the greatness of Kenpo, but I'm curious what in it what in Kenpo drew you, kind of pulled you away from the Taekwondo part of it. Was there a particular aspect that just made you go all in, or?
Well, there were several things that did it. As a police officer, retired police officer of 25 years, and that didn't happen, of course, until I came to Louisiana. But what attracted me to Kenpo was the lightning speed of the hand movements, and how quickly somebody, an opponent, could be dominated and come out successful. And it wasn't a matter of just demolishing somebody. It was the hands, it was the dexterity of the hands, even more so than the feet. And the way the techniques performed, I had never seen anything like it before. Nothing that I had done or seen before that even compared to it at the time. Now, that's not to say that other arts are not effective, because they are. But for me as an individual, with my lifestyle, what I was doing, that's what fit me better than anything else. And part of that was, when I was 5 years old, I fell over a bridge, and I've had lower back problems, degenerative disc disease, ever since. So I had to choose an art that was better suited for me than Taekwondo was. And the dexterity of the hands with it is what attracted me the most. And every time I saw an advanced Kenpo move, it just drove the fire even deeper. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to learn. This is what I want to advance at.
Gotcha. Now, since you know, since the be beginning there, have you trained in any other systems, or?
I have. Besides Taekwondo, I've trained in Isshin-Ryu. I've done a little Shotokan, but not enough to mean a whole lot. I ventured into the Tracy system of Kenpo, of course, the IKCA. There were other Kenpo systems out there that they mostly did video correspondence. And I've seen most of those, but I never did anything with it. Because in some cases, I wasn't satisfied with what I was seeing. And it wasn't until Grandmaster Sullivan and Grandmaster LaRue that I saw what it was really like, right up close and personal. And that also confirmed people like Grandmaster Larry Tatum, and Grandmaster Huck Plantis,
there are so many of them out there that had such an extensive amount of knowledge that it was just, I just kept going with it. I've been able over the years to gather material from Grandmaster Tatum and from the late Grandmaster Huck Plantis, Grandmaster Tim Bulot, Joe Whalen, and now some of the people that are coming up now, these generations, there are some absolutely phenomenal people that are going to turn out phenomenal students as well. They were taught by what I consider some of the greatest, and they are going to bring the future of Kenpo just right into the spotlight with some fantastic martial artists.
Yes, very nice. Now, something that you mentioned earlier that struck a chord with me was mentioning that there when you got involved with Chuck Sullivan, how there were people that were saying that there was kind of too much material, you know, too many basics and too many techniques and such to learn. And it struck a chord with me as the first Kenpo school that I started with. We were essentially doing that of a kind of the Tracy's curriculum or an early version of the Ed Parker's teachings. And in that school, we did 40 techniques each belt. And the school that I'm with now, we're on the 16 technique per belt curriculum. And I always kind of have a laugh with my classmates. They're talking about, oh, there's so much to learn. And it's like, well, I had to do way more than this when I started out. So 16 each belt is not too bad. So
no, it's really not. When I started out, we were in the 32 curriculum. And then while I was there, it switched to the 24. And of course, later then with Grandmaster Brian Duffy, with Parker's permission, I believe he put out the 16 technique curriculum. Now with mine, there's only 10 techniques per belt. There's only 10 techniques per belt, except for person second degree black, which there are a total of 15, which equals the 110. And it wasn't, with me, it was more of a matter of spreading it out over a greater period of time with the belts. You're still getting the material in there. It's just that I can recall people in this day and age that I've taught over the years that when they look at it and they say, wait a second, yellow had 10, now I've got to learn this many more. And by the time they would get to, orange, they had learned 24 techniques. By the time they would get to purple, they would almost forget what they had previously learned. So my entire goal with it was to make sure that when I taught you a belt with the 10 techniques or freestyle techniques, that I made you spend enough time on it to where it was ingrained in you so you didn't forget it. So as you look forward, you don't see a Mount Everest in front of you. Instead, you see a shorter mountain that you can actually see and understand that you can actually get over that hump, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I like that. That's good. So just to make sure that I'm clear. So you teach a system that is a variation of Chuck Sullivan's system or.
No. I teach a system that is primarily based on Parker's, but I don't claim it as Parker's Kenpo. And the reason why is because we've done a lot of name changes. You can take a system and you can take an original system and you can rearrange it any way you want to and call it something else, but it's still going to be the original. So what I did is I didn't want to take the Parker system and mess it up because there was no reason for it to be messed up. It's gotten to the point where in our day and time, everybody unfortunately wants stuff faster. Okay. And that includes sometimes belt ranks. And I'm of the old school, which means you're going to spend time on this until you get it right. Instead of just, I'm going to advance you because you've been here 3 months, and 3 months later, I advance you again. Because the object for me is not just to turn out a good martial artist, it's turn out somebody who can think on their own, not just simply repeat a sequence of movements. And the Parker system has a lot in it. The original system has a whole lot. And none of it's wrong. It gives enough information throughout it to where you're not left at the end of it answering any, trying to ask any other questions, because it's all there for you. The only thing I did was modify some of the stuff, some of the techniques along the way to make it fit more of what happened on the street now. Because as a retired police officer, what I can tell you is you can take anything you want from a studio, but when you get out on the street, it ends up becoming a different story. And when you're performing a technique on somebody in the studio, a lot of times the opponent that you're going against is trained to react a certain way, which comes down to realistic positioning and the realistic reaction. If I do a technique like leaping crane and I collapse your arm and then I kick the back of your right knee, technically you would go down on one knee with your back facing the attacker. But in most cases, when you kick that knee, they're going to roll on their back, which means the remainder of the technique is not going to work unless before they fall, you grab their shoulders and pull them back towards you. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And when I was on the street for those 25 years, there was a lot of time, more times than I can count, where I got into altercations to where I realized that you're going against people who are not trained. And so the reaction is going to be, to a certain degree, different. And I realized, well, wait a second, this person reacted this way, not the way I thought they would. And that's where you have the modifications that come in.
Yes.
So where you end up with more of a realistic reaction. And that's not to put down or degrade any kind of, you know, studio training, because you've got to start somewhere. But it's based on how every strike, every kick that you do in Kenpo, what you do is going to cause a reaction in that opponent. And instead of just learning a sequence of movements and do it exactly the same way every time, there's what's called, split-second monitoring. And that split-second monitoring will tell you what to do next. That way you're not looking at your teacher and saying, well, you taught me that sequence of movements and it didn't work. Well, what did your opponent do? Well, they did this. Well, then we follow up with this instead. And you do it at a slow enough rate to where it doesn't overwhelm them. That was the purpose for only putting 10 techniques per belt rank.
Yeah. Keeping it simplified and just using the things that work at its core is definitely one of the strengths of Kenpo, and in that it is very open and very kind of designed to be modified and customized to the practitioner and not beholden to specific traditions and, you know, oh, well, they, you know, did this, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago, so we got to still do it that way. It's like, you know, times change, mindsets change, all of the different, there's a lot of different variables that go in and Kenpo as a base is very good at being able to modify that and change that to fit the situation and fit the individual. So that's something that I've always enjoyed about the art. And it looks like you've taken advantage of that model and made it your own and made it what works. You've had these kind of real world experiences and had kind of the modifications and And did it really significantly kind of change the system and the way that you teach it? Or was it kind of more common sense sort of things, or just you know, like you mentioned, a lot of the people that we use these sort of things on are untrained. So kind of going at it from that mindset, did it really significantly change not only your system, but just kind of your view of Kenpo in general?
It did. It really did. And I keep going back to this, but the doing police work changed everything. You know, way back in the days, we were taught always just do it the way you were taught and leave it alone and don't question it. Well, that's okay. But if you do that way back then, and then one of your students gets attacked and they do exactly what you taught them to do, and they do not come out victorious, they come back and they say, well, you're not a good teacher. What's wrong? No. It's that along the way, just like you said, along the way, you have to teach them that things can change in a split second. Whether it's leaping crane, whether it's dance of death, or any other technique, remember that anything can change in just a millisecond, and you have to change with it. As you know, and as everybody else knows, in the original Kenpo, Parker's Kenpo, you had the base move, which was the first half. Then you had the extension, which is the second half. Now, the base move, of course, can be effective if it's done right. Now, I don't like to use the word extension. I would rather use the word follow up, because you can take one technique and just say, well, this is the extension for it, when there should be several follow ups that you can do based on how your attacker responds to a strike, a punch, or a kick, or what have you. And that goes back to getting the students to think about what they're doing, not just do a bunch of techniques like just exactly the same way I do them. Let them think, let them employ the basics, let them look at the situation. So this is what I would do. And I teach them enough material, and I have them do it with enough repetitions, not to memorize that specific sequence, but to memorize the basics that you're putting in there in combination, and be willing to change those as the incident dictates at the time. Because one of the things I do is I go by what the late Grandmaster Parker said: we're not teaching you specific sequence, we're teaching you ideas. And ideas change over time. They don't stay the same. For example, when it comes to attacking, you have to use a realistic attack to get a realistic reaction. When it comes to a step-through punch, in the very beginning, it's fine to teach it the traditional way. But when you do a right-through step-through punch, rarely anybody does that anymore. When I'm teaching to a student how to defend themselves, let's say, for example, outside of a right punch, I stand in more of a boxer's position, and I shoot that right hand out like I'm throwing a jab, because that's more of what you're going to see out there on the street. No one's going to step back, do a downward block, and then step through with a punch. It doesn't happen that way. And that's one of the things that being out in the street taught me so well. Is, wait a second, hold on. I don't have that kind of time to go back into the proper position all the time in order to make this work. I have to move from where I'm at. Now, of course, I still teach all the stances. I still teach stance sets, blocking sets, striking sets, and teach the forms. But I teach everything in the sequence of its importance. Basics first, self-defense, freestyle. And a lot of schools don't even teach freestyle anymore. It was, I think, last year on, I believe it was YouTube, I saw an insert in there on freestyle. And as I had to comment for the guy that was teaching it, because the comment was, nobody teaches this anymore, hardly. And the Kempo artists that I saw in there, absolutely phenomenal. Jamie Seabrook, I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Oh, yes. He was actually my first guest, so yes.
Let me tell you what. I watched him doing his freestyle sets, and I watched him doing some other stuff, and I went, this is the way it needs to be passed on. And when I've watched people like Frank Vigoro, you know, whenever I watch him, I thought, well, you know, this man's all the way in New Jersey. But if I was to ever, if one of my students ever had to move up that direction, I would say, let me write you a letter of recommendation right now. Because like I said, you know, we've got so many phenomenal ones coming up that it just blows the mind. And it's not so much the color of the belt they have around their waist. It's not so much how many stripes they have or how many bars they have. It's what they're doing with what they've been taught and how well they're advancing it for this day and time.
Gotcha. Now, so you did kind of touch on something that I was going to ask about. If, you know, since your system is more focused on the street aspect, if you were teaching forms and sets as well. So I'm curious, has there been any other systems that have made its way into what you teach as well, or is it just still strictly Kempo based?
As far as what I do?
Yes.
As far as what I do, it's still pure Kempo. It is. There's other systems out there that are Kempo that have been developed by other systems that have been developed by other people. And they're very skilled, they're very qualified to do so. I think one thing that everybody knew that was going to happen is when Mr. Parker passed away, there was going to be a branching out of different systems that came alive, and they did. And a lot of people say, well, no, we shouldn't do that. Well, that's what he wrote a long time ago. That's what was expected. And that's what we see happening. One of the issues is everything's based on the principles and concepts of the art. And Mr. Parker put that together ever so well. You know, if you fall in line with the principles and concepts, then the technique is correct. And if you follow the basics of Kenpo, the basics, that's where it all begins anyway. Now, when you start changing the basics from the original versions of them, that's when you run into problems. You know, a lot of people nowadays, they look at forms, they look at sets, and they think, well, this is kind of a waste of time. No, just like it was taught a long time ago, those sets are small dictionaries of motion that put everything together. We do a punching set, we do several blocking sets, stance sets, and such, and striking sets. And when you do those, instead of standing in front of a mirror and doing a straight horizontal punch 80 times, if you do the punching set as we do it, you're doing it every time you do it, you're doing several punches at one time. So as part of it takes out what students would call boredom. And it puts it into more of a dictionary of motion. It makes it more fun. It makes it more captivating. And it makes them want to get in there and do it more. When you take a single stance, like switching from a neutral bow into a forward reverse bow, and crossovers and step drags, when you put them into a set, every time you do one set, you're doing several stances several times. And it gets the body, the joints, and everything in motion so that you get so used to it that the transitions become that much easier. That's why those sets and forms are so vital and so important.
True. I like it. Now, so, and just to clarify, so you have added your own sets and forms and whatnot, or?
I have to a degree. Some are kind of similar, some are different. when it comes down to our forms, such as short one, short two, long two, short, you know, long two, short two, long two, when it comes down to those, ours are done differently. And the reason why is because I found another way to do them, sort of a more of a modern approach. It doesn't make the old versions wrong. And let me clarify that it doesn't. But we do it in a different way, partially because I wanted to make sure that there was a separation and not just say, well, this is the 110 system. No, that's the Parker system. No, we're still following the principles and concepts. Just because the form is a little bit different doesn't make it not Kenpo.
Gotcha, gotcha. Now, what about things like weapons? Do you teach dealing with those? Have you added anything from your experience into the system?
The bow staff. You can still pick up a stick anywhere on the street if you can find one, a branch from a tree. The main thing before teaching how to fight, how to do that, is teaching a person how to defend against a weapon. Now, there are instructors out there, I will not mention names, but there are instructors out there who do not believe in teaching anything against a gun or defense against a knife, a chain, or anything. And I understand it completely. The reason why I chose to have those in the 110 system is because of my experience on the street. I did not have a choice but to do that. I couldn't simply, if I was in a situation to where I had a gun pointed at me or a knife, I couldn't just say, excuse me, sir, this is not going to work. Let me go back to my car and get my taser. If I was in a position where I had to do something right then and there, then I had to make sure that the techniques that I was doing was going to work and work correctly. And when I teach against knives, especially, one of the things I do is I'll have a person wear a white t-shirt and I'll take a black marker or a yellow marker. And when the person who's attacking is doing that and they're performing the self-defense technique on them, every time they have a mark on their uniform or on their shirt, it means you just got cut. And the whole object is to prevent that from happening. Now, a lot of people, when they're defending against, especially a knife, they end up focusing on the knife. And yeah, you should. But what I also teach my students is to focus on what's holding the knife. It's being held by the hand with the fingers wrapped around the handle. The fist is connected to the forearm and so forth. That's common sense. So if I can disable the arm, I can disable the knife that it's holding. It's the same way with a stick. If I can disarm the hand, and I can do a maneuver to knock the stick out of the hand and the knife. Now people say, well, by doing that, you're going to get cut. You might. There's a possibility. But when you're put in that situation where you have no choice but to do that, you have to make sure that the techniques are not just what's popular, not just what looks fantastic, but actually what works. And I've used them on the street in my 25 years of police work, and I'm happy to say I haven't been cut yet. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen. But when I'm attacked with a weapon, I take it absolutely serious. And I've made sure, and I've struck the human body on the arm exactly where it needed to go to make sure because as a cop, the one thing that I can say is the number one goal we have is to go home after every shift. That raises your mental awareness up so many high notches. It does. And like I said, it's not the fact that you can't get hurt because you can. It just means that your practice and your skill level has to increase that much more to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, too. I like it. Now, since you have this kind of real world experience, what would maybe be some misconceptions about the self-defense aspect of it. So to clarify it a little bit more, a lot of us, you know, we train the martial arts because we want to be able to defend ourselves. And I would say the majority of the people that train with the mindset of being able to defend themselves or being able to fight well, I would say majority people have a kind of idea of how things play out when they're faced with having to use their skills. So I'm curious if there's any things that you're familiar with that are maybe kind of the common ideas of what it is to use your skills for real. So I'll give kind of another example. One of the guests that I've spoken with have been doing Kenpo and martial arts for a very long time, and they spent a lot of time as a bouncer, and they mentioned that they got into lots and lots of different altercations, and they've never once had the need to go to the ground. So sorry, internet people, not going to try and start any drama or anything, but there's certainly a lot of people that have, taken notice of course, the rise of things like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and grappling and a lot of schools and teachers will sell you on the fact that, or I should say the idea that, oh, okay, all fights are going to go to the ground and this and that. And, we won't get into that debate or that issue. But this person that I was talking to was like, oh, well, I've been in hundreds of situations and never once did we go to the ground. And so I'm just curious in your experience, what are maybe a couple of ideas that most people have that maybe doesn't really kind of play out that way.
Well, that's an outstanding question. And let me give you two examples. One of the arts that I've done for a short time was Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I couldn't continue it because I had neck surgery and I had three disc replacements with a plate. And the instructor at the time lived just about, an hour and a half from me. Excellent, excellent guy. But I couldn't continue with it because I couldn't go full force as you would need to do. And as far as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, when they say every fight's going to go to the ground, no. Because I've experienced that on the street. The only time we ever had to go to the ground is if you have more than one person that's helping you take somebody down, and the only way you're going to get the handcuffs on is to put them on the ground, because they're just not going to stand there long enough for you to put a pair of bracelets on them. That's a fact. But now if it's just a matter of and that's talking about restraining somebody. When it's talking about self-defense itself, do you have to be taken to the ground? No. Now, can you be taken to the ground? You bet. That's like saying you're never going to get stabbed. Okay? There's always that chance. When it comes down to, and especially in the way I teach it, when it comes down to grabs and holds, for example, or being charged at with somebody bent over like a football player trying to take you down, what I teach my students is don't wait for the full Nelson to get fully applied. Don't wait for the bear hug to get fully applied. The very second that you sense those arms coming around you, the very second that you feel those arms, that grab happening, move. Don't wait until it's fully applied, because you may not get out of it. As soon as you feel it happening, that's when you move to prevent that from happening. For example, a bear hug. Somebody walks up behind you to get you in a bear hug. They're not just grabbing you to say hello. If it's an attacker, they're going to try to pick you up and throw you to the ground. If it's a full Nelson or if it's a rear chokehold, when they put that right arm around your neck and they take the other hand to try to choke you out, by that time, it could be too late once your air supply is cut off. So as soon as you sense that happen, that right arm comes around your neck, take your right hand and grab that wrist and pull straight down. It doesn't mean you're going to pull it completely off of you, but you're going to keep your breathing constant, and it's going to give you just that much time to be able to end the altercation and get away from there. And of course, that doesn't mean defend yourself, stand there and look at him to see if he's going to get back up, especially if you can get away. Just monitor the situation long enough to find out, am I going to have to fight him again? Or is it over? And when it comes down to striking, when your life, you know, if you're a person in a parking lot at night, leaving Walmart or whatever, and you're attacked, your object is not a little slap on the wrist. Your object is to inflict enough pain to where that person says, I don't want any more of this. Okay? When I'm teaching my students, especially if it's a teenager, and especially if it's a female, the last thing I want to hear is one of my students got attacked and didn't survive it because I didn't teach it right. I want to make sure and I'm not talking about any incapacitation, I'm just talking about making sure that they do enough to where that person wants to leave them alone. When I train people, one of the things I don't do is allow any of my students to spar against each other or do self-defense techniques against each other. I'm the one they do it against. And I, even though I wear protection, I teach them to hit. And the reason why is, if you won't hit in the studio, you're not going to hit on the street. So I take the abuse myself so that when they get out there, they know exactly what it's like to kick. They know exactly what it's like to punch, to chop, to strike, or hammer.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. Yeah, how you train is going to be how you operate when you're in the real situation. In our school, we have a story when we're doing things with sticks and knives. We don't hand the weapon to each other because there was a story of someone that actually did that in the street. They handed the bad guy a knife, and the bad guy proceeded to stab him with it because it was so used to doing it in training. Just, oh well, we do the technique and then you hand the knife back to the person so you can do it again. And so we don't always realize that sometimes we build that muscle memory, and that's the kind of habit that you don't want to have in a real situation. So
absolutely not. Because how you train in the studio is how they're going to do on the street. I'm sure, of course, you know that I'm also the CEO of the International Kempo Karate Academies, which is not, of course, the original IKKA. And one of our board members is Grandmaster Tim Bulot from Texas. He, as well, still is a sheriff deputy. And his work is phenomenal as well. And I'm sure he can attest to the way things are on the street, that you have to end it quickly and you have to end it effectively. And I just know from my experience that, and like I said, you know, I may take a lot of abuse from my students, but let me tell you what, if a 15 and a half year old female can hit me and I feel it, or she can throw a kick, a roundhouse kick at the back of my leg, and I can feel it, that means that the person out there in the street, if she's attacked, is going to feel it. And that gives me great confidence that my students are going to be able to take care of themselves.
I like it. I like it. That's, yeah, it's important to be able to really put that, you know, put what we're learning into practice in, as most realistic way as possible, because, God forbid that we actually do have to use what we're learning, want to be prepared. So, I like that. I like that approach of making sure that, we're really hitting, we're really going at it as much as we can, so that we can be prepared mentally and physically, regardless of who we are. So, I like that.
So, well, and I'll add one last thing. On my Facebook Kenpo site, when I post something, especially whether it's my students' promotion or them doing a self-defense technique while I'm the attacker, as I've had a lot of comments, all right, Paul, well, we've seen them, but we'd like to see you do something. And they will, but I'm not after the spotlight at all. I appreciate this podcast and the opportunity for it, but I'm not after the spotlight. I would rather them watch my students and see what they can do at their levels. That's what's most important to me. I can get out there and do the form sets all day long, and it may look impressive, but I want you to see my students and what they can do. Because whenever if I throw a club attack at one of my students, and at the end of it, they're taking the club away from me and hitting me three or four times with it. That's good.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. One other item that I wanted to get into, since you've been involved in Kenpo and in martial arts for quite some time, I'm curious on a couple of things. One, are there things that maybe training methods or things that we, or I should say, well, more so you used to do back in the day that maybe we've gotten away from and you wish that would come back, and kind of vice versa? Are there things that we do now that maybe wish would have done earlier in your training?
Well, two things. Train realistically. Attack your students realistically. And I'm not saying try to take their head off, but let the attack come at them in a realistic manner, but in a controlled fashion, because nobody wants their students hurt inside of a studio, ever. And repetition. Monitoring your students. Doing a technique. I mean, take a technique simple as delayed sword. A student comes in and does it 25 times. They come in three more times. They do it 25 more times each time. After 100 times, they move on to alternating maces. They need to do it enough times to where it's ingrained in their memory. One of the issues that I've had for a long time is a lot of people nowadays expect a specific timeline with their promotion to different belts. Okay? I have, when I interview a student and their parents, I tell them, there is no timeline. I can't tell you when you're going to get your first belt. I can't tell you when you're going to get your second belt. That's going to be based on two things: my teaching, your retention, your desire, and how bad you want it, and how good do you want to be. I will not give away a belt just because you've been there 6 months. That doesn't happen with me. You've got to earn it, and you've got to show me that what I've taught you, you can do, and you can actually use it. Now, I don't, at a yellow belt, I don't expect you to perform like a black belt, but I do expect you to put the passion in and do the movement and show me at least a degree of effectiveness. Because when it comes to that, I'm very old school. I will not give away a belt. Either you earn it or you don't get it.
Exactly. That's the way it should be. I like it. So then kind of the next part here before we move to our lightning round, as I like to call it. So with kind of all of these different ideas and divisions and just kind of changing of ways, I'm curious, what are your thoughts, hopes, kind of general ideas about kind of the future of Kenpo? Where do you see it going? Where would you like to see it go? And even if you have any kind of thoughts on how we might be able to kind of unify, you know, of course there's all kinds of, and Kenpo is it's not just in Kenpo. All the arts have their divisions and different ideas and you know, drama and that sort of thing. But I'm just kind of curious where you see Kenpo going, and where would you like to see it go in the future?
I would like to see it flourish. I would like to see, if possible, and it's not everywhere, but of course you have it everywhere in police work. You have it, you know, in martial arts politics, as I call it. I would like to see it flourish as far as taking careful observation of how things change year by year, of how things are done. And I would like to see people have less fear of modifying something to make it to where it changes with the modern ways of combat. And not to say, well, no, I can't do this because tradition says I can't. No, yes, you can. As long as you're qualified to do it, there's nothing that says that you can't. And what I see out there right now is, and there's more than a handful, there's a lot more than a handful. I see it, the future, especially with some of the martial artists that you're seeing today, especially Kenpo. I see some phenomenal future teachers out there. And when I said, you know, like when I mentioned Frank Vigoro, that I would write a letter in a heartbeat for him to accept one of my students if one of my students had to move up there. When it comes to people like that, because they're not just mimicking, they're not just following the movements of who taught them, they are actually making the art their own. As one time it was told to me, all right, you know delayed sword, okay? I taught it to you, but now that delayed sword now belongs to you. It no longer belongs to me because you're the one that's now doing it. And 50 years from now, if you're still doing it, it's still your delayed sword, not mine. So in turn, the art needs to be that person's art, even if you learn from somebody else, because at that point, it's been given to you. You can put any title you want on it, but it's still your Kenpo. It's still your Taekwondo. Even if you're under an organization, still, you have to follow their rules and bylaws, yes. But it's still yours. It's the gift that you were given. It's the gift that you nurtured. It's the gift that you ended up mastering. The other thing is when you see somebody else doing something different, just because it's different doesn't mean it's wrong. And what I do is if I take a technique that I know that I'm doing a certain way, and I see somebody else doing it another way, and I see that their method is more effective, I don't discard it. I go, oh, that's cool. We need to keep this in our memory banks. And a lot of times we look at a person, the belt that's wrapped around their waist, and we judge them by that and say, well, I can't learn anything from that person because they've only got 4 stripes and I've got 8. No. You can take, like, for example, my student Luke Booker, who's a former amateur kickboxer. He's 5 feet something inches tall. excellent physical condition, 45 years old, strong as an ox. And there are times when when I've taught him techniques, and because of certain, physical abilities or lack of, well, Mr. Paul, this is not working for me. Every time I do this, this happens. Would it be okay if I did this instead? Absolutely. That's the whole point of it. It goes back to the theory of the table of the tailored suit. It didn't change the name of the technique, and it didn't change what you were doing. You just had to adapt it to that person to make it effective for them.
Okay. All right. So we're going to move into our lightning round here. Got a few little questions for you as we head towards a close for our time today. The first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Well, I could give the most popular, typical answer that everybody gives, which is five swords.
That's one of the Kempo All-Stars, as I like to call it.
It is five swords. That's where you learn what they call the machine gun effect. Mm-hmm. there's so many. There's the backbreaker. And of course, now I'm calling out these names as everybody knows them, mm-hmm. not necessarily as the names that we use, but the backbreaker, leaping crane, parting wings, thundering hammers. It as glancing spear. We do it as glancing palm. Mm-hmm. But there's just a host.
Gotcha.
And I'll add this too. I've had students over the years who, it's not that there was too much in the system. It's just that they said, just give me 10 techniques that I can use really good. And that's all they wanted. But then I went back to explain to them. I said, do you know why we gave you so many? He said, no. I said, that way you have more tools.
Exactly. More tools in the toolbox is key.
Yeah, because, you may do a technique 1,000 times and still not be able to use it. And you could do a technique 20 times and be able to use that one.
Exactly.
Because not every single technique is going to work for everybody, and you have to expect that. I'm not going to hold back a belt from you because of the fact that one technique is giving you problems. We're going to keep changing it. We're going to keep modifying it, not to take away the principle of it, but keep doing it until it finally works for you.
I like it. Good. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Favorite form that... I would have to say the original form four and the original six. Now we don't do the forms the same way. I'll tell you that now. The favorite set right now with us would be our hand set or number two striking set. And the others are our number one stance set and our number two stance set. And then, of course, the finger set.
Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
My hands.
Good answer. I like it.
Well, let me tell you why I say that. Is
you can grab a wrench, you could grab a brick, you could grab a rock, okay? And everybody carries a weapon or a gun around in their vehicle, as I do. But you're going to be most times you're going to be caught with just your hands and feet. So my favorite weapon is my hands.
I like it. That's good. Good answer. Good answer. All right. Okay. Next question there. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Well, even though the belts we wear are the same as far as rank goes, I've already trained with Chuck Sullivan and Vic LaRue, so I can't count down. Somebody that I haven't, one of them would have been, and I've met him and talked to him several times, was Hawk Planus, Grandmaster Hawk Planus. The other one would probably be Larry Tatum.
Excellent, excellent. I like both of those. Good answers there. All right. Then the last question there. What is something that inspires you to train? Now, I use the example of the movie Rocky IV, when he's having the little training montage and he's chopping the wood and he's running through the snow and the music's playing and stuff. Anytime I watch that, I get hyped up, I get fired up to train and hit the mats, hit the studio. So what is something like that for you? And it could be anything. I mean, a movie, a song, a book, or, you know, whatever it is, that thing that inspires you to get out there and train.
Well, first of all, you mentioned the Rocky movies. That's kind of ironic. They're some of my favorite movies. Whenever I'll watch any of the Rocky movies, especially the Rocky Balboa, not the original one, but the one later where he basically retired. Mm-hmm. And then Creed's son comes along and wants to be trained by him and says, I don't do that anymore. Well, I'm at the point now I can still do everything. But now my inspiration is not watching myself in the mirror doing anything as far as training. It's passing what I have learned over the years to other people and watching them get good and watching them progress. And when I watch a Rocky movie, I almost feel like I'm almost turning into that person who sits down in that chair with a stick in his hand and is training other people. The only difference is, as I'm still at 63, I'm still able to move. I'm still able to do everything I teach my students to do. And the inspiration is just to keep going, just to keep going as long as I can, and just produce not just good, outstanding students.
I like it. That's that'll get me going. So I like that. Now, so our last thing here is time for shameless self promotion. So now is your time to plug anything that you'd like, or if there's anything that you wanted to make sure that we got out today that we didn't cover. Now is your chance to say whatever you'd like. You have the floor, and then we'll close out from there.
Well, first of all, I want to, you know, hats off to every previous, the ones that have passed, previous grandmasters who gave us the inspiration and fire to keep going. And all the ones that are still left with us. Don't discard what they had been around for a long time. They went through struggles just like we went through struggles. They agreed, they disagreed with each other, but they were still friends. Everybody out there, when you find a Kenpo artist that is fully qualified, don't take them for granted. When they take the time to teach you something, record it down, write it down, but don't forget about it and don't take it lightly. Because it's because of what the first generations did for us, and we are now in a place where it's going to be our responsibility to keep that flame going. Don't let the flame burn out. I'm the type of person that I no longer teach group sessions unless I'm doing a seminar. I only teach private lessons because I want my attention for that 1 hour to be solely on that one person so they don't miss a thing and I can make sure I make every correction that's necessary. Whether you train under Jamie Seabrook or Frank Bogoro or Tatum or any of them, they're not just opening their mouth and saying something for their health. They're saying it for your benefit. Listen to every word that comes out of their mouth and take it. Learn from it and don't take advantage of it. That'd be it.
Very, very well said. Very well said. I like it. All right. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on and sharing your story. And, you know, there's so many things that we can get into, but, you know, we only have so long of a show. So as I tend to do with all of my guests, we'll definitely have to do a part two and three as we go along. But yeah, I just thank you so much for being on and sharing your story. And I'm excited to be able to share that with the listeners. And yeah, I'm looking forward to getting that out. So once again, thank you so much for being on and sharing your story.
And I thank you for the opportunity to do such. And if I happen to be ever be invited on again, if so, I'd be happy to do it.
Oh yeah, no, you will definitely get another invite, and we will have you on again, and we can get into some more specific topics and just kind of go from there. But yeah, thank you so much, and I will be in touch when this is ready to go out.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.